Good afternoon and welcome to From Where We Are, stories of news and culture through the lens of USC and Southern California. I'm Joshua Chang, coming to you from Los Angeles, California.
And I'm Luke Scorzel, coming to you from Lake Arrowhead, California.
And this is our last hurrah for the semester. As we bid this crazy and uncertain semester farewell, we would like to share some of the news we've gathered throughout the semester.
The stories you'll hear on this show have all been reported remotely. USC students across the world brought us the news from where they are to where we are.
As our last few weeks of school wind down, many students are wondering if we'll be back on campus next fall.
I hope so. The university is considering several options, being in person, doing a hybrid of being online and on campus, or potentially just being online. These decisions highlight questions of public safety and health, which are at the forefront of what we'll decide what we do next semester.
And to answer some of these questions, reporter Spencer Kelly spoke with the Dean of the Keck School of Medicine, Dr. Laura Mosqueda.
On Monday, Laura Mosqueda, Dean of USC's Keck School of Medicine, held a Zoom meeting with students and faculty from the Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism to discuss USC's collective response to the COVID-19 pandemic.
You know, we have some great leadership like Sarah Van Norman, who is over student health and has real expertise in public health. And here at the Keck School, we have epidemiologists, virologists. And so we really have an extraordinary group of people here at USC who are very heavily engaged with the provost and the president, and with a variety of other leaders from your school, engineering, Dornsife, et cetera, putting our heads together on the path forward.
Mosqueda also explained the steps she thinks will be necessary for combating COVID-19 as we return to life on campus.
It's going to be a multimodal kind of approach. Testing will not be the be-all and end-all. It'll be an important component, but only a component. Using apps in order to do some contact tracing is also, I think, going to be very, very important. Having classrooms come back online in ways that make sense probably is going to be a hybrid sort of thing, so that we're not going to be sitting packed person to person in classrooms anymore, where people will have to be spaced out so that there's a minimum of 6 feet apart. I can imagine that we're going to want to limit the size of groups that get together. All of those things are being actively looked at and discussed right now.
For Annenberg Media, I'm Spencer Kelly.
So while we'll be thinking about that decision over the next few months, we have other things on our minds, which is that the school year is almost over, and with that, so are our leases.
Oh, don't mention it. My lease ends in July, and I really don't know how I'm going to move out. Speaking of which, I heard you have some moving out to do as well.
Yeah, I live in university housing, so I actually had to schedule my moving out appointment a few days ago. Not exactly how I expected the year to end, but I don't think anyone really expected that. But reporter Will Cass brings some other student reactions to the moving out process.
Students received emails about how to retrieve their belongings from USC Housing. Students will have to schedule an appointment online for the day and time they will be coming to campus. This date will need to correspond with the student's designated resident group, which is determined by the first and last number of their room. Faith Hotchkiss, a freshman majoring in International Studies and French, will be returning to campus during the first week of May to collect the rest of her belongings. She lives in Ventura County and understands why some students might be nervous about coming back to campus.
I'm not nervous about going just because I know that I have like a mask and gloves and my mom's coming with me, so I feel safe. But for some people who don't have access to that, or even some people who have to fly, it might be, obviously more worrisome.
Some students are unable to fly back to collect the rest of their things and will have to have USC remove and store their belongings for them. Twesha Deekshit is a journalism and cinema and media studies major from India. She's concerned about USC Housing's lack of communication.
They haven't given out any details about how it'll work. So the first time I emailed them, I was sort of like requesting storage, but I was told to email them again. and mention what things I wanted to be stored. So then I emailed them again. And again, they said that they had received my request and they would forward it to the web housing services or whatever and get back to me with details.
Zach Connor is a cognitive science major from Oklahoma. He's concerned about potentially violating LA's stay-at-home order, which is in place until at least May 15th.
I have been keeping updated with the emails, and they are quite confusing because they have dates that don't line up with some of the rules that the city of LA has like set in place due to the pandemic.
Both Connor and Deekshit are concerned about having strangers handling their belongings, but are unable to fly back to move out their rooms themselves.
I just have a lot of things, and I'm not like the neatest person, and I myself can't exactly keep track of all the things I have. I don't know how comfortable I feel about the fact that there will be someone else going through all my things and I won't like physically be present.
With these concerns over putting strangers in charge of moving students' belongings, the process of moving out of university housing has become a difficult one. If the stay-at-home order is lifted on May 15th, then retrieving belongings should become easier for students still in California, as they have the option to move out until May 22nd. However, students out of the state or country will continue to struggle with logistics as they make tough decisions over whether moving out is worth the journey.
That story was reported by Will Cassie, Bailey Harrison, and Vincent Lowe. With moving also comes new beginnings. Even with COVID-19, USC is expected to welcome the class of 2024 next fall.
And part of welcoming them has always been summer orientation, the first introduction to campus.
And it looks like the newest Trojans are going to have to do that in our favorite video conference platform, Zoom. Jaewon Jung brings us a story from the Office of Orientation.
Summer orientation for incoming freshmen is an exciting time to learn about USC and get to know the campus. Except this year, summer orientation is not on campus. With the rise of the growing COVID-19 pandemic, all summer programs have moved online.
We have it set up so that all of the essential things are being taken care of, information that needs to get out, registration, academic advising. Then we're also going to have opportunities for the incoming students to interact with our orientation advisors.
Bethany Baudin is an orientation coordinator for this fall semester. She says the offices are working to get the incoming students to interact, but a remark from Los Angeles Mayor Eric Garcetti has the LA community distressed.
Nothing I've heard would indicate that we'll be in those large thousands of people gathering anytime soon, and probably not for the rest of this year.
So what could it mean for the USC community if both incoming and current students don't have face-to-face interaction until 2021? Lisa Starr is director of the orientation offices. She says even during these uncertain times, the offices are making sure students are prioritized.
Theme is to fight on, and we will make sure that these students feel connected to the university. This isn't unique to USC. It's certainly every university in the country. So there are a lot of great people working to make sure that these students feel part of the Trojan family.
For Annenberg Media, I'm Jaewon Jung.
When this was all starting, I remember never really thinking about masks, and they just seemed to be kind of a distant thing in my mind. But now I'm actually legally not allowed to go outside of my house in public without one in San Bernardino County.
And as masks become an integral part of our daily lives, we are facing mask shortages across the country, especially as healthcare professionals and essential workers also need them to do their jobs.
So while the situation is slowly improving since earlier in the pandemic, L. Davidson explains why we had this mask shortage.
As the summer approaches and orders to continue practicing social distancing and to shelter in place stretches on, many Americans are left wondering how the country could be so unprepared for this pandemic. In late February, President Donald Trump reported that 40 million masks would be distributed to healthcare workers. But according to accounts from first responders, doctors, and nurses, the supplies never reached those who needed it. And if it did, the supplies are dwindling. USC professor Andrew Lakoff, an expert on the politics of disaster response, has been looking in depth at the country's shortcomings and how it has responded during the crisis. He says the supplies in the Strategic National Stockpile were there, but it hasn't been enough.
The National Stockpile is a set of warehouses scattered around the country, about six of them. Their contents are actually classified, and they were initially set up in the late 1990s and early 2000s, mainly to prepare for the possibility of a bioterrorism attack.
Because of this, the stockpile does not contain many of the supplies needed for the coronavirus outbreak, such as masks and ventilators. What we do have are enough smallpox vaccines for the entire country and countermeasures to address bioweapon attacks.
For the most part, the contents of the stockpile, from what I can tell, have not been a topic of national debate until it was revealed in the aftermath of the pandemic that it did not have the supplies we needed or that we did not have protocols in place for fairly distributing the supplies that we have.
As a result, hospitals and first responders have faced dire shortages of key resources.
Preparedness partly involves what you've stored in advance. And arguably, I think that there were scenarios out there that showed that if there were a serious contagious respiratory disease, we would need much more protective equipment.
But the critical issue lies in the actual distribution of medical supplies, according to Lakoff.
Healthcare workers haven't had sufficient protective equipment, and that's been really devastating and made hospitals much more dangerous places than they otherwise would, both for hospital workers and for patients.
Since the federal government invoked the Defense Production Act in March, American factories have been helping to create more medical supplies, including swabs and ventilators. As many states approach their peak in coronavirus cases, the effectiveness of this measure and the national stockpile will continue to be tested. For Annenberg Media, I'm Elle Davidson.
There are a lot of Good Samaritans around the world who are helping others by making masks and giving them away. In Southern California, one healthcare worker who thought she retired rose to the occasion to combat COVID-19. Anisha Banerjee brings us the story.
Diane Tikotsky is a retired emergency room RN. So when COVID-19 hit, she felt she had to do something to help.
I texted my old manager and my educator and I said, hey, do you think anybody would want these homemade masks? I made a couple and they're like, why don't you ask on Facebook?
So she did. And within the same day,
I got tons of yeses.
Tikotsky donates her quirky, colorful masks to the hospital where she used to work in Upland, California, in San Bernardino County, the town just east of where she lives. Some went to people she used to work with.
Your nurses, physicians, techs, but also some nurses in the GI lab that I know and love, some people in radiology, some people, neuro nurse navigators, and so like quite a few different people.
Tikotsky makes these masks out of quilting material she normally uses to make quilts. She designs her masks specifically with healthcare professionals in mind. She includes a pocket in her masks and puts a piece of vacuum cleaner bag in it.
And it's supposed to increase the efficacy almost as much as a surgical mask. Yesterday, I started putting interfacing in, which is just kind of a stabilizer.
Before the pandemic, Jill Garcia owned a children's clothing store called Malibu Sugar in Malibu, California. Now, the store has been running online and has been manufacturing clothing with a factory in downtown Los Angeles. So when LA mandated that people wear masks in public, she had an idea.
There are companies that have a lot of fabrics, but those companies had to close with the stay-at-home order. I knew that in our warehouse, we had fabrics. I was like, well, how can we use these the best?
The answer was clear.
That I had heard actually was already making masks and said, hey, if I bring you fabric, could you make masks for me? And they said, yes.
Garcia has sold almost 2,000 masks wholesale nationwide and directly to consumers through her store's website.
We offered to them to send them to our stores that are all over the country, because now it's pretty much a thing to, like, there's a lot of areas that have the cloth mask requirement.
She added that manufacturing masks has not only helped a good cause, but also helped her business and employees during this crisis.
Our business pretty much had to shut down. So it allowed me to keep my employees, even though it was just part-time.
She has no idea how long the demand for masks will last.
I feel like this is going to be a new way of life for us. So as long as there is a need for that, we will definitely continue.
For now, the demand just keeps growing. But when we find a way to help, making one mask or 1,000 masks, it can give us some sense of contributing and of having at least a little bit of control in the face of a great unknown. For Annenberg Media, I'm Manisha Banerjee.
You know, I can't really remember the last time that I ate out. I actually can't. It's not coming to me, Josh. but restaurants in particular have been hit hard by stay-at-home orders. Many of them have closed down or are furloughing staff as they can no longer afford to stay in business. However, even in these hard times, eateries across Los Angeles are still providing free food to healthcare workers who do not have the time or the energy to cook. Celine Mendiola brings us some of those restaurant owners on this next story.
When the pandemic began, Barbara Lavolsi didn't want to sit idly by. She wanted to help, especially since one of her friends is a nurse at Keck Medical at USC. But with the recent safer at home measures, what could she do? Lavolsi, who is a mother of three, met her friend who works for Keck Medical at her child's preschool. She decided to turn to her community to find a way to help. At first, she tried to collect masks for the hospitals, but the effort,
as you can imagine, was sort of slim pickings, and we came up with like 25 masks. I got her the mask. But then I thought, what else could we do to help her?
Meanwhile, Erica Docking, the owner of Topo by Kitchen Mouse in Northeast Los Angeles, was forced to make tough business decisions in the face of the pandemic. Because business slowed down dramatically, she had to furlough much of her staff. Within a few weeks, Topo went from 72 employees to 8.
We didn't let anyone go in the hopes that when this is all over, we can return to business as usual, with the understanding that that may take quite a while.
That's when Lavolsi realized she could help two friends with one fundraiser. On March 25th, she started a campaign on GoFundMe to raise money for meals to feed healthcare workers at Keck Medical Center. According to the GoFundMe page, all of the money raised will go toward helping to feed hospital staff while also supporting Topo by Kitchen Mouse. The goal is set for $25,000. 2 weeks into the campaign, more than 100 people have donated almost $9,000. That was enough for Docking and the staff of Kitchen Mouse to start feeding the staff at Keck Medical. And for Docking, the experience opened her eyes to how dire the situation is for medical workers.
These staffers are working super long shifts and getting very short breaks to eat. And in that time, they can't really go order food, or, you know, they don't have the access to meals in a quick, easy way. And that really made us realize that the need is there in a deeper way.
That's why restaurants all over the LA area, from local businesses like Kitchen Mouse to larger chains like The Habit, have been working to provide free meals for these hospital workers. At BV's Bakery, a kosher bakery on Pico Boulevard, owner Dan Messinger teamed up with Darren Milamed of Pizza World to deliver cookies and pizza to local emergency rooms. For every two boxes of cookies or pizzas that a customer sponsored, Messinger and Milamed would match it with their own donations. Messinger even created a special cookie to show his gratitude for health workers. A scrubs shirt-shaped cookie with a stethoscope and thank you iced on top.
I think of really just the gesture. I think it can probably get lonely, even though they're all together there. They feel like they're on their island doing the work. And for them to know that there are people on the outside who are appreciating them, I think goes a long way.
Messinger also hopes the enthusiasm for these types of projects won't be temporary.
In a couple weeks, if this is just the norm where we're all just used to being at home and doing everything by Zoom and ordering in and all that, like, maybe we'll be like, oh, yeah, all right, I guess the doctors are working hard. if we have things like this, we can constantly remind everyone that they're working beyond the norm, and that we can show them that we appreciate that and that we are supporting them in their effort.
That concern is on Lavolsi's mind too, as her GoFundMe continues to raise money. As of April 6th, the funds will also be used to support teams at the UCLA Medical Center. For Annenberg Media, I'm Celine Mangiola.
COVID-19 has hit the most vulnerable among us. As we report in the next few stories, that includes homeless populations, those addicted to drugs, and even small towns.
California's homeless population now, more than ever, is in dire need of care and attention. Sam Feehan tells us how COVID-19 has affected essential programs and critical services offered to our more vulnerable neighbors.
During these stressful coronavirus times, home feels like one of the only environments free from the risk of contagion. But in order to be safe at home, someone must have a home to go to in the first place.
You know, any kind of encampment, I would assume that it would spread pretty quickly. Everyone's living in really close confines. And like, even if you're in your own tent, it's not really that isolated.
That's Jesse Goldshear, a doctoral student in USC Keck's Health Behavior Research Program. It's a field of study which includes volunteering and outreach work for groups all over LA. For outreach workers like Goldshear, who dedicate their time to assisting the homeless, coronavirus creates a whole host of new issues on top of an already complex and critical process. Treating the homeless can also increase the risk of outreach workers contracting COVID, so organizations have had to change how they interact with their clients to ensure health, down even to the method of handing out supplies.
Operating from inside vehicles has become big, so rather than just handing things to people, you know, everything will be done through the window.
Offering aid without spreading the virus is a puzzle outreach groups across the entire nation are working to solve. In neighboring Nevada, authorities have painted grids in parking lots to ensure social distancing amongst the homeless while they sleep. And 10 shelters have sprung up in cities from Tampa to Boston, with more being proposed every day. And the outreach vehicles that Goldshear mentions are becoming near ubiquitous. However, they may offer an imperfect solution.
In the sense that that person-to-person interaction, you're getting to know each other, you're building trust, you're building that capacity. And so when you're not getting that, it feels a little weird.
With confirmed cases quickly appearing on Skid Row by the end of March, however, it's clear that the work outreach groups offer is as critical now as it's ever been. Groups like Homeless Healthcare of Los Angeles and Covenant House are still running programs including food, showering stations, needle exchanges, shelters, and emergency services to those experiencing homelessness and addiction. The silver lining exists, however, in the fact that many organizations, such as California Volunteers, have seen an uptick in engagement and interest on their social media posts, with so many at home spending time plugged in. It's hard to know, though, if that engrossment will outlive COVID. In these stressful times, those who put their own safety on the line for the betterment of others will prove critical in the fight against coronavirus. For Annenberg Media, I'm Sam Fian.
For many struggling with substance abuse, building a community at a treatment center helps them on the road to recovery. But with the ongoing pandemic, many centers are finding other ways to maintain the sense of community. James Hoffling has more.
On October 7th, 2016, I walked into a long-term drug and alcohol treatment center. I had just turned 31 years old, I was 45 pounds underweight, and I was utterly helpless. My mother drove away with tears in her eyes, hoping that this would help me. I had been addicted to heroin for 7 years. The treatment center I attended completely changed my life. It gave me tools to handle my problems with a new solution. I was able to bare my soul in group settings where other men who had gone through the same things I had helped me to face my guilt, shame, and trauma. Over the 3 years I stayed there, I was able to talk to many different men on a daily basis. This community atmosphere was necessary for my recovery, which has led to a dramatic change in where I am today. But COVID-19 has changed that for treatment centers. Some of these changes include no group interaction, being locked down in bedrooms with no more than 3 people to a room, and requiring that appointments with counselors take place over the phone or through Zoom. What does that mean for the landscape of this type of treatment that has worked for many people? Archie Hogan is the development coordinator at the Beacon House, a men's drug and alcohol treatment center in San Pedro. He says the new restrictions have been a challenge.
With the disease of addiction, you know, one of the things we teach here, and in general, it's a, you know, it's a very, you know, you have a fellowship or you have a community. And so that community has essentially been, you know, put on hold. And so we have telehealth where we have, you know, counselors or therapists from their home setting where we'll set up a computer and they can do individual counseling. You know, there's also online AA Zoom meetings. And so there's a lot of, you know, trying to adjust.
COVID-19 has also changed the way that students on campus at USC are going about recovery. For USC alum Sophie Pine, she knows that struggle all too well. She had her own battle with addiction while in college. Now, her mission is to help students who may be facing similar experiences. Pine is the National Director for University Relations at The Haven College, an organization that brings clinical support services and recovery housing for 10 different campuses across the nation, including USC. Before stay-at-home orders were issued, The Haven College was providing support to 200 students in their care nationwide, including 10 who are in their sober living on the USC campus. The pandemic hasn't changed that level of support.
We actually decided to keep the sober living residents open, support our students who really wanted to stay at the residence. We gave them the option of leaving to go home as the following the university's lead. But many of our students actually wanted to stay with us because that's where their community is. And we know that recovery thrives with community.
Pine adds that it's important for the students in their care to have structure.
For those who are in early recovery, learning new skills and new tools, ways to cope with maybe cravings or the feelings that they're dealing with now, and learning not to either self-medicate or use to get out of those feelings is often really challenging.
Amidst COVID-19, the disease of alcohol and drug addiction does not stop. This is a really difficult time for people around the world, and the addition of a problem with addiction can make life seem impossible. But it is possible to get help. There are people who are dedicating their lives to helping others. I know that I would not be in the position that I am in today if it weren't for the people who helped me face my addiction. For Annenberg Media, I'm James Hoffling.
For small vacation towns, a coronavirus outbreak is a frightening thought, especially when they don't have the healthcare infrastructure to deal with a lot of coronavirus cases. As Julia Barton reports, Bishop, California has closed down rock climbing to tourists after seeing an alarming number of visitors despite the global pandemic.
You got it. Keep going. After California issued stay-at-home orders, hundreds of rock climbers hit the road to Bishop, a small town south of Mammoth known for its bouldering. Among the desert rocks and Joshua trees, they were hoping to find some escape from crowded cities. But Bishop is tiny. It's a highway town along the 395 with about 3,500 residents and only 20 hospital beds. Beds they want to keep open for people who may come down with the virus.
The numbers from that weekend matched the numbers of popular long or holiday weekends.
That's Lauren Dulani, the communications director for the Bishop Area Climbers Coalition. With the Sierra Nevadas on one side and the Mojave Desert on the other, Bishop's cell service is pretty spotty. But in the interest of social distancing, I talked to her over the phone.
So at first, we were saying, if you can really limit your travel right now, that would be really great for us. And 3 days later, we had essentially asked people in really precise language, like, please don't come to Bishop for climbing travel right now.
The Bishop City Council echoed her request, urging climbers and visitors to stay away. A bulletin on the city's website says Bishop is a small town with a big backyard and a small hospital, and they can't support climbers visiting right now.
That's the way these things tend to go, is if we can self-police, then they don't get taken away from us, but when we can't, then those agencies are allowed to step in and kind of do it for us.
When some climbers didn't listen to calls to stay inside, other regulatory bodies in the county stepped in as well. Here's Ron Phillips, Bishop's city administrator.
Well, many of the areas that are available are now being closed by
Forest Service, so there's not going to be much available until this is over.
The Bureau of Land Management has now posted a $5,000 fine for anyone in the Happy Boulders, a popular Bishop climbing spot, hoping to keep climbers and hikers out of the area.
I feel like we also just want to have some empathy with people.
That's Dulani again.
It's beautiful out. We know that it's going to be really hard for people who want to go out hiking and want to go out and do these things. And I think that there's a way to do that. But we also just think that climbing is, number one, too dangerous, and number two, involves touching surfaces that can hold a virus potentially. So what that means, if you want to follow the CDC guidelines, it just means no climbing for now.
Between CDC guidelines and fines for climbers who don't stay inside, California climber traffic has all but stopped for the time being. For Annenberg Media, I'm Julia Barton.
Two, a one. Two, a one, two, three, four.
What about you, Josh? Maybe you're not climbing, but are you getting out at all?
Oh, God, no, not much at all. You know, I think I'm getting the cabin fever. The other day I went out to throw out some trash, and I just really hit me how warm it was.
Yeah, honestly, me too. I've had a couple of bike rides and walks, but not really too much. I can't even remember the last person I hung out with other than my parents. As Sophia James reports, though, we're not alone. A lot of other people are also going what they call stir crazy.
As a student, all my classes have gone online, and I've started reporting from my bathroom studio, which has the best sound in my house. Despite connecting with peers via Zoom and talking to friends and family on FaceTime nearly every day, I found that being inside and on screen all day has made me feel like I'm going crazy. Going from lots of in-person daily interaction and socialization to virtually none in such an abrupt manner can come as a shock. When combined with a requirement to stay confined in your home, it can lead people to experience what is known as cabin fever or going stir crazy. Stir craziness is the negative psychological and mental health effects that can result from being physically confined or contained in one space for an extended period of time.
Human beings are social animals. We have a sense of reality based on our interaction with other people around us.
That's Dr. Terry Coopers of the Wright Institute in Berkeley. He's extensively studied the psychology of isolation, specifically its effect on prison populations.
If there's too much isolation, all of these things become impaired and people start doubting themselves. They have trouble testing reality. They just feel bad and they often can't put it into words. But the real truth is that they are social animals being denied social contact.
He's also described some of the negative effects of social distancing and how it leads to this feeling of craziness.
When the people we can relate to is drastically and suddenly reduced, empirically, we can observe that people have problems. The less control we have, the more inclined towards despair that we are.
Isolation can also affect people's productivity. This is especially hard right now when so many people are doing classes or working from home. Dr. Lawrence Palenkis from USC's School of Social Work is an expert on social isolation in extreme environments.
It's social and environmental stimulation. Sometimes we begin to exhibit a slowing down of cognitive functioning. You know, we're not as sharp or as alert as we normally are because the brain needs that kind of external stimuli in order to be efficient.
So if social distancing can effectively lead to all these negative mental health effects, how can we avoid or combat them? One way is to maintain social contact with friends and family through video calling and messaging. Dr. Palenkis also stressed the importance of being kind to yourself and creating realistic expectations for productivity.
People have to be realistic about what they can accomplish and not stressing over the failure to accomplish what they hope to.
As hard as it may be, it's important to maintain as much normalcy in social interactions as possible to avoid feelings of isolation or despair. A bit of stir craziness may be inevitable, but there's lots we can do to keep ourselves and the people we love sane. For Annenberg Media, I'm Sophia James.
While we might not be getting out, a lot of college students are still finding ways to date. Kinda.
Yeah, I have a few friends actually who are using Zoom backgrounds for location dates to places like Paris, without actually being there, obviously. Others are using MatchSC, which is a new dating website for SC students advertised on the meme page.
And with this MatchSC's help, love in COVID-19 is still thriving? Yasmin Balzi brings us a story.
Did you get, like, your match and stuff back?
Yeah, I did. Yeah, I got it, like, yesterday morning, and I, like, looked them up, and I was like, I don't know if I would, like, necessarily, like, get along with this person super well.
Do you think, like, people were using it because they're lonelier now, or do you think it's more like they were just kind of bored in quarantine and it just seemed like a fun thing to do?
I think it was a little bit of both, honestly, because everyone had so much free time, they were like, I might as well. But a lot of people who I talked to, like, in the past week were like, oh, yeah, like, oh, it'll be so great when I get my match. Everyone was kind of holding out hope that it would maybe be someone that they could actually, like, pursue something with because everyone is so bored.
I feel like people have gotten to the point, you know, they're so bored of dating apps. And now that they've added, like, this FaceTime feature. So, like, what do you think about that?
Dating apps have always scared me. But I think, like, FaceTiming and, like, having that be an option kind of, like, decreases some of, like, the anxiety and, like, impersonalness of everything. That's really interesting to me, too.
People are always so scared about a first date. And, like, I feel like now people's first dates are over FaceTime.
Yeah, yeah. It definitely does take away some pressure. But then it kind of, like, makes everything, like, a little bit more casual. I was seeing I met on the street. Like, and that was the perfect situation for me because I, like, met them on the street, like, talked to them for a little bit, and then got their phone number because we, like, vibed a little bit.
I miss so those days.
I know, I miss it. And, like, that's kind of, like, my only requirement for meeting someone. So, like, dating apps have always been, like, even with MatchSC, I was like, I don't know if I should do it because I really, like, value, like, meeting someone and, like, feeling out, you know, like, where our chemistry is or, like, how well we get along. So it was a really interesting experience. I mean, I definitely probably do it again when I get back to school or even, like, wait and see what happens with it. But that's probably just because, like, I have nothing else to do and I'm probably not going to see, like, other human beings for months.
Again, that was Yasmin Balshi reporting on that story. The birds are chirping, the air is warming up, people are sneezing, not because of coronavirus. It is spring, and the only thing missing are graduations with mass amounts of graduating college seniors. Now, we would typically be getting ready to say goodbye to our graduating friends, and good luck, and hopefully see you later, but I don't know if that's the case.
Yeah, with the ongoing pandemic, almost every graduation in the country has been either postponed, canceled, or moved online, and that includes USC's.
And while USC has promised seniors an eventual in-person graduation, for now they are celebrating with a virtual one. Elle Davidson spoke with several graduating seniors about this virtual celebration.
With in-person graduation plans on hold, the class of 2020 has been left to their own devices to celebrate commencement. Though diplomas will be conferred virtually, any plans for family to come to Los Angeles and celebrate have been put on an indefinite hold. I spoke with a few USC seniors to find out their plans for graduation amid the pandemic.
We'll be watching the virtual conferring of degrees online, which is something I'm kind of looking forward to because I'm interested in how they'll actually do it online and still make it fun for us. And then on top of that, I will also be having, like, a small get-together with my family, obviously following social distancing guidelines under 10 people.
I am not planning to celebrate my commencement until coronavirus is over. I will not be logging into the virtual graduation. I think it's really depressing and a poor substitute. The school has also promised that we'll have an in-person celebration once coronavirus is over, but I'm honestly expecting that to not happen.
I know that there's a planned later commencement, but I know that me and my friends were talking about, as a joke, having a funny Animal Crossing graduation. But so far, I think on graduation day, I'll be sitting in my backyard with some iced tea and thinking about my future.
You know, I'm looking at this as an opportunity to really spend time with my family. You know, we'll probably all sit down together. You know, I have this month to spend time with them that I really wasn't expecting I was going to be able to. So, you know, really trying to take a positive out of the situation.
I plan on tuning in on May 15th for the Zoom ceremony. Although if I'm going to be honest, it really doesn't mean anything to me. More than anything, I'm excited for the in-person graduation, and truly as a senior, like, none of this is going to feel real until we are able to walk across that stage.
You just heard from law history and culture student Leanna Lugo, psychology student Joanne Mallory, music production student Elon Wertman, computer science and business administration student Matt Mertu, and communication student Naomi Hyman. With Annenberg Media, I'm Elle Davidson.
So yeah, Luke, I mean, as USC students and as student reporters, we have been through a lot, I think, in the past few weeks as COVID-19 hit us. How has it been this, you know, how's this semester been for you?
Yeah, I mean, it's a little strange because it has probably been one of the best semesters yet in terms of my classes. Reporting has been great. This is our second semester together as producers, so I was really looking forward to the content that we would produce. And we still did produce a lot of content, but obviously not in the way that we expected. So, you know, it's just been making the most of a situation that I guess we can't really control at all. How about you? You're a junior heading into your final year at USC.
Yeah, no, honestly, this is not how I expected my junior year to look. You know, some say that, you know, your junior summer is the most important summer in terms of your career and, you know, and preparing yourself for graduation. But that's all that's suddenly gone. And it is, you know, it is frustrating. It is annoying. It is frankly scary because of the uncertain futures that are, you know, that is ahead of us. But, you know, I think like you said, I think it's important for us to be thankful of what we have and making the best of what we have. And that is the same feeling I want to bring in, even if, you know, this may continue throughout the fall.
Absolutely. I think a spirit of gratitude and resilience will get us through this. And speaking of that, we have some thank yous. A special thank you to Sebastian Grubaugh, Victor Figueroa, and Graham Clark, and also to our amazing radio instructors Tina Rubio and Edward Lifson, and our fantastic Media Center fellow Tracy Lee. Thank you all. None of this, especially this semester, would have been possible without you.
And a big, big thank you to Willa Seidenberg, Annenberg Media Center's faculty advisor. The radio program you built has been home for so many of us over the years and turned out so many incredible journalists.
And of course, our producers, Yuki Liang, Zazie Lippert, Rebecca Katz, Isaiah Murtaugh, Evan Jacoby, and Ayanna White.
Oh, and Luke Scorzell.
Yeah, and I think Joshua Chang, too. And a big shout out to our hosts, Taylor Bazil, Lauren Habroni, Waylon Cunningham, and Michaela Stevens.
The radio you heard today is a production of USC Annenberg Media, and it was all recorded and produced remotely. For these stories and more, head to uscannenbergmedia.com and click on the radio tab to listen. You can find us on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook at Annenberg Media.
You can also go to the App Store and check out our new app. It's called Annie. And finally, before we head off to summer break, we'd like to thank you, our loyal listeners, including my own mother, for tuning in every Tuesday and Thursday. I'm Luke Scorzell.
And I'm Joshua Chang. Stay safe, be well, we'll get through this. We hope you'll join us again in the fall for From Where We Are.